Chapter 71. I'd best go and settle the score, James continued. C couldn't think of asking you, ma'am, he added, generously. This delicacy made his aunt laugh the more. Go and settle the bill, Bowles, she said, with a wave of her hand, and bring it to me. Poor lady, she did not know what else he had done. Here there's a little dog, said James, looking frightfully guilty. Thee best go for him. He bites footman's calves. All the party cried out with laughing at this description, even Briggs and Lady Jane, who was sitting mute during the interview between Miss Crawley and her nephew. And Bowles, without a word, quitted the room. Still, by way of punishing her elder nephew, Miss Crawley persisted in being gracious to the young Exonian. There were no limits to her kindness or her compliments when they once began. She told Pitty might come to dinner, and insisted that James should accompany her in her drive, and paraded him solemnly up and down the cliff, on the back seat of the barge. During all this excursion, she condescended to say civil things to him. She quoted Italian and French poetry to the poor bewildered lad, and persisted that he was a fine scholar, and was perfectly sure he would gain a gold medal, and be a senior wrangler. Ha, ha, laughed James, encouraged by these compliments. Senior wrangler, indeed, that's at the other shop. What is the other shop, my dear child? Said the lady. Senior wranglers at Cambridge, not Oxford, said the scholar, with a knowing air, and would probably have been more confidential, but that suddenly there appeared on the cliff in a tax cart, drawn by a bang-up pony, dressed in white flannel coats, with mother-of-pearl buttons, his friends the Tutbury Pet and the Ratigny in Fibber, with three other gentlemen of their acquaintance, who all saluted poor James there in the carriage as he sate. This incident damped the ingenuous youth's spirits, and no word of yea or nay could he be induced to utter during the rest of the drive. On his return he found his room prepared, and his portmanteau ready, and might have remarked that Mr. Bowles' countenance, when the latter conducted him to his apartments, wore a look of gravity, wonder, and compassion. But the thought of Mr. Bowles did not enter his head. He was deploring the dreadful predicament in which he found himself, in a house full of old women, jabbering French and Italian, and talking poetry to him. "Are glarly up a tree, by jingo!" exclaimed the modest boy, who could not face the gentlest of her sex, not even Briggs when she began to talk to him, whereas, put him at Iffley Lock, and he could outslang the boldest bargeman. At dinner, James appeared choking in a white neckcloth, and had the honor of handing my Lady Jane downstairs, while Briggs and Mr. Crawley followed afterwards, conducting the old lady, with her apparatus of bundles, and shawls, and cushions. Half of Briggs' time at dinner was spent in superintending the invalid's comfort, and in cutting up chicken for her fat spaniel. James did not talk much, but he made a point of asking all the ladies to drink wine, and accepted Mr. Crawley's challenge, and consumed the greater part of a bottle of champagne which Mr. Bowles was ordered to produce in his honor. The ladies having withdrawn, and the two cousins being left together, Pitt, the ex-diplomatist, became very communicative and friendly. He asked after James' career at college, what his prospects in life were, hoped heartily he would get on, and, in a word, was frank and amiable. James' tongue unloosed with the port, and he told his cousin his life, his prospects, his debts, his troubles at the Little Go, and his rows with the proctors, filling rapidly from the bottles before him, and flying from port to Madeira with joyous activity. The chief pleasure which my aunt has, said Mr. Crawley, filling his glass, is that people should do as they like in her house. This is Liberty Hall, James, and you can't do Miss Crawley a greater kindness than to do as you please, and ask for what you will. I know you have all sneered at me in the country for being a Tory. Miss Crawley is liberal enough to suit any fancy. She is a Republican in principle, and despises everything like rank or title. Why are you going to marry an earl's daughter? Said James. My dear friend, Remember, it is not poor Lady Jane's fault that she is well born, Pitt replied, with a courtly air. He cannot help being a lady. Besides, I am a Tory, you know. Oh, as for that, said Jim, there's nothing like old blood. No, dammy, nothing like it. I'm none of your radicals. I know what it is to be a gentleman, dammy. See the chaps in a boat race. Look at the fellers in a fight. Aye, look at a dog killing rats, which is it wins, the good-blooded ones. Get some more port, Bowles, old boy, whilst I buzz this bottle here. What was I saying? I think you were speaking of dogs killing rats, Pitt remarked mildly, handing his cousin the decanter to us. Killing rats, was I? Well, Pitt, are you a sporting man? Do you want to see a dog as can kill a rat? If you do, come down with me to Tom Corduroy's, in Castle Street Mews, and I'll show you such a bull terrier as Pooh. Gammon, cried James, bursting out laughing at his own absurdity. Oh, you don't care about a dog or rat. It's all nonsense. I'm blessed if I think you know the difference between a dog and a duck. No, by the way, Pitt continued with increased blandness, it was about blood you were talking, and the personal advantages which people derive from patrician birth. Here's the fresh bottle. Blood's the word, said James, gulping the ruby fluid down. Nothing like blood, sir, in horses, dogs, and men. Why, only last term, just before I was rusticated, that is, I mean just before I had the measles, ha, ha, there was me, and Ringwood of Christchurch, Bob Ringwood, Lord Cinqbur's son, having our beer at the Bell at Blenheim, when the Banbury bargeman offered to fight either of us for a bowl of punch. I couldn't. My arm was in a sling, couldn't even take the drag down a brute of a mare of mine that fell with me only 2 days before, out with the Abingdon, and I thought my arm was broke. Well, sir, I couldn't finish him, but Bob had his coat off at once. He stood up to the Banbury man for 3 minutes, and polished him off in 4 rounds easy. Gad, how he did drop, sir, and what was it? Blood, sir, all blood. You don't drink, James, the ex-attaché continued. I in my time at Oxford, the men passed round the bottle a little quicker than you young fellows seem to do. Come, come, said James, putting his hand to his nose, and winking at his cousin with a pair of vinous eyes. No jokes, old boy, no trying it on me. You want to trot me out, but it's no go. And vino veritas, old boy. Mars, Bacchus, Apollo Virum, hey? I wish my aunt would send down some of this to the governor. It's a precious good tap. You had better ask her, Machiavel continued, or make the best of your time now. What says the bard? Nunc vino pellite curas, cras ingens id arabimus equer, and the bacchanalian, quoting the above with a House of Commons air, tossed off nearly a thimbleful of wine with an immense flourish of his glass. At the rectory, when the bottle of port wine was opened after dinner, the young ladies had each a glass from a bottle of currant wine. Mrs. Bute took one glass of port, honest James had a couple commonly, but as his father grew very sulky, if he made further inroads on the bottle, the good lad generally refrained from trying for more, and subsided either into the currant wine, or to some private gin and water in the stables, which he enjoyed in the company of the coachman and his pipe. At Oxford, the quantity of wine was unlimited, but the quality was inferior. But when quantity and quality united, as at his aunt's house, James showed that he could appreciate them indeed, and hardly needed any of his cousin's encouragement in draining off the second bottle supplied by Mr. Bowles. When the time for coffee came, however, and for a return to the ladies, of whom he stood in awe, the young gentleman's agreeable frankness left him, and he relapsed into his usual surly timidity, contenting himself by saying yes and no, by scowling at Lady Jane, and by upsetting one cup of coffee during the evening. if he did not speak beyond in a pitiable manner, and his presence threw a damp upon the modest proceedings of the evening. For Miss Crawley and Lady Jane at their picket, and Miss Briggs at her work, felt that his eyes were wildly fixed on them, and were uneasy under that maudlin look. "He seems a very silent, awkward, bashful lad," said Miss Crawley to Mr. Pitt. "He is more communicative in men's society than with ladies," Machiavel dryly replied. Perhaps rather disappointed that the port wine had not made Jim speak more. He had spent the early part of the next morning in writing home to his mother a most flourishing account of his reception by Miss Crawley. But he little knew what evils the day was bringing for him, and how short his reign of favor was destined to be. A circumstance which Jim had forgotten, a trivial, but fatal circumstance, had taken place at the Cripps Arms on the night before he had come to his aunt's house. It was no other than this Jim, who was always of a generous disposition, and when in his cups especially hospitable, had in the course of the night treated the Tutbury champion and the Ratingdean man, and their friends, twice or thrice to the refreshment of gin and water, so that no less than 18 glasses of that fluid at 8 pence per glass were charged in Mr. James Crawley's bill. It was not the amount of 8 pences, but the quantity of gin which told fatally against poor James' character, when his aunt's butler, Mr. Bowles, went down at his mistress's request to pay the young gentleman's bill. The landlord, fearing lest the account should be refused altogether, swore solemnly that the young gent had consumed personally every farthing's worth of the liquor. And Bowles paid the bill finally, and showed it on his return home to Mrs. Firkin, who was shocked at the frightful prodigality of gin, and took the bill to Miss Briggs as accountant general, who thought it her duty to mention the circumstance to her principal, Miss Crawley. Had he drunk a dozen bottles of claret, the old spinster could have pardoned him. Mr. Fox and Mr. Sheridan drank claret. Gentlemen drank claret. But 18 glasses of gin consumed among boxers, in an ignoble pothouse, it was an odious crime, and not to be pardoned readily. Everything went against the lad. He came home perfumed from the stables, whither he had been to pay his dog Tozer a visit, and whence he was going to take his friend out for an airing, when he met Miss Crawley and her wheezy Blenheim spaniel, which Tozer would have eaten up had not the Blenheim fled squealing to the protection of Miss Briggs, while the atrocious master of the bulldog stood laughing at the horrible persecution. This day too the unlucky boy's modesty had likewise forsaken him. He was lively and facetious at dinner. During the repast he leveled one or two jokes against Pitt Crawley. He drank as much wine as upon the previous day, and going quite unsuspiciously to the drawing room, began to entertain the ladies there with some choice Oxford stories. He described the different pugilistic qualities of Molyneux and Dutch Sam, offered playfully to give Lady Jane the odds upon the Tutbury pet against the Ratingdean man, or take them, as her ladyship chose, and crowned the pleasantry by proposing to back himself against his cousin Pitt Crawley, either with or without the gloves. "Indeed, that's a fair offer, my buck," he said, with a loud laugh, slapping Pitt on the shoulder, "and my father told me to make it too, and he'll go halves in the bet, ha, ha." So saying, the engaging youth nodded knowingly at poor Miss Briggs, and pointed his thumb over his shoulder at Pitt Crawley in a jocular and exulting manner. Pitt was not pleased altogether perhaps, but still not unhappy in the main. Poor Jim had his laugh out, and staggered across the room with his aunt's candle, when the old lady moved to retire, and offered to salute her with the blandest tipsy smile. And he took his own leave, and went upstairs to his bedroom perfectly satisfied with himself, and with a pleased notion that his aunt's money would be left to him in preference to his father, and all the rest of the family. Once up in the bedroom, one would have thought he could not make matters worse, and yet this unlucky boy did. The moon was shining very pleasantly out on the sea, and Jim, attracted to the window by the romantic appearance of the ocean and the heavens, thought he would further enjoy them while smoking. Nobody would smell the tobacco, he thought, if he cunningly opened the window and kept his head and pipe in the fresh air. This he did. But being in an excited state, poor Jim had forgotten that his door was open all this time, so that the breeze blowing inwards, and a fine thorough draft being established, the clouds of tobacco were carried downstairs, and arrived with quite undiminished fragrance to Miss Crawley and Miss Briggs. The pipe of tobacco finished the business. And the Bute Crawleys never knew how many thousand pounds it cost them. Firkin rushed downstairs to Bowles, who was reading out the ire, and the frying pan to his aide-de-camp in a loud and ghostly voice. The dreadful secret was told to him by Firkin with so frightened a look, that for the first moment Mr. Bowles and his young man thought that robbers were in the house, the legs of whom had probably been discovered by the woman under Miss Crawley's bed. When made aware of the fact, however, to rush upstairs at three steps at a time, to enter the unconscious James' apartment, calling out, "Mr. James," in a voice stifled with alarm, and to cry, "For God's sake, sir, stop that ear pipe," was the work of a minute with Mr. Bowles. "Comma, Mr. James, what have you done?" he said in a voice of the deepest pathos, as he threw the implement out of the window. "Had have you done, sir? Miss Sis can't abide 'em." "Miss Sis needn't smoke," said James with a frantic misplaced laugh, and thought the whole matter an excellent joke. But his feelings were very different in the morning, when Mr. Bowles' young man, who operated upon Mr. James' boots, and brought him his hot water, to shave that beard which he was so anxiously expecting, handed a note into Mr. James in bed, in the handwriting of Miss Briggs. "Dear sir," it said, "Miss Crawley has passed an exceedingly disturbed night, owing to the shocking manner in which the house has been polluted by tobacco. Miss Crawley bids me say she regrets that she is too unwell to see you before you go, and above all that she ever induced you to remove from the alehouse, where she is sure you will be much more comfortable during the rest of your stay at Brighton." And herewith honest James' career as a candidate for his aunt's favor ended. He had in fact, and without knowing it, done what he menaced to do. He had fought his cousin Pitt with the gloves. Where meanwhile was he who had been once first favorite for this race for money? Becky and Rawdon, as we have seen, were come together after Waterloo, and were passing the winter of 1815 at Paris in great splendor and gaiety. Rebecca was a good economist, and the price poor Joe Sedley had paid for her two horses was in itself sufficient to keep their little establishment afloat for a year, at the least. There was no occasion to turn in two money Y pistols, the same which I shot Captain Marker, or the gold dressing case, or the cloak lined with sable. Becky had it made into a pelisse for herself, in which she rode in the Bois de Bowland to the admiration of all. And you should have seen the scene between her and her delighted husband, whom she rejoined after the army had entered Cambrai, and when she unsewed herself, and let out of her dress all those watches, knick-knacks, banknotes, checks, and valuables, which she had secreted in the wadding, previous to her meditated flight from Brussels. Tufto was charmed, and Rawdon roared with delighted laughter, and swore that she was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.